It is Friday, October the 26th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, U.S. bomb threats and heightening political tensions.
Most responsible for this angry political atmosphere we have in the country right now is the President of the United States.
Thousands of migrants hoping to have a future in the U.S.
This is a very vulnerable group of people who is desperate to leave their country because it has grown very dangerous for them, life-threatening even.
Also ahead, Brazil's presidential election, an American Fall Festival, plus something from the world of music. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. U.S. investigators are looking for clues to lead them to the person or persons responsible for package bombs targeting reported critics of President Trump, including billionaire businessman George Soros, former presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, California Congresswoman Maxine Waters, and many more. Well, the story now from AP's Ed Donahue.
New York Mayor Bill de Blasio says this is definitely terrorism.
Because it's an effort to use violence to make a political impact.
Inspector Phil Bartlett says some of the packages were sent through the Postal Service.
We have over 600,000 postal employees out there right now, so we have their eyes and ears looking for these packages.
NYPD Commissioner James O'Neill was asked if these devices can detonate or if they're just meant to scare people.
We have to treat them as live devices. This is a protocol that our bomb squad people use, and it keeps everybody safe.
Two packages were sent to former Vice President Joe Biden, who says America has to turn off this hate machine. I'm Ed Donahue.
And as authorities retrieve more bombs sent to prominent Democrats, President Trump is largely blaming the news media for an angry political atmosphere in the U.S. In his Twitter feed, the president suggested that the media was a big part of the anger in the United States today. He says it's hateful beyond description and called for the mainstream media to, in his words, clean up its act fast. White House VOA Bureau Chief Steve Herman speaks with our colleague here, Sarah Williams, about Mr. Trump's latest tweet regarding the news media.
The president had mentioned the news media in his rally in Wisconsin, where he called for unity and people to watch their language. But today he's back to the Donald Trump that's very familiar on Twitter and lashing out at the media, referring to it again as fake news and saying it's gotten so bad and hateful that it is beyond description, and calling for the mainstream media to clean up its act fast. And of course, as you might imagine, some of the mainstream media, some of the reporters basically tossing this back towards the president, saying they're reporting objectively on the things that he's doing and saying. And if there's anybody who's most responsible for this angry political atmosphere we have in the country right now, it is the President of the United States.
He seems to have particularly clashed with CNN, also he also often mentions the New York Times, but CNN, the New York Bureau of CNN, was one of those places targeted with these devices.
Right. I would note, however, that recently when he has sparred directly with correspondents from CNN and the New York Times, he has both criticized them and then praised some of their reporting. So it depends on a day-to-day basis of where he's at on that. And I should mention that he continues to take questions from both CNN and the New York Times regularly, even giving the New York Times correspondents here at the White House a recent interview in the Oval Office.
Actually, I have heard that one editor was saying that he actually speaks to the press more than former President Barack Obama did.
Oh, he's extremely available, not in the way that we had seen in previous administrations where you would have these formal news conferences, but he takes questions during the so-called pool sprays when a group of photographers, videographers, and journalists, including broadcasters, come in a small group to usually watch the president sign something. President Obama did not speak during those, going out to the South Lawn to board Marine One. Again, President Obama and other presidents would rarely stop to answer questions, but more often than not, President Trump stops. And I've also thrown questions at him, besides in the Oval Office, also on airport tarmacs when he'll come over and speak to a small group of us. So in that way, he is extremely available and responsive to the White House press.
That's Steve Herman. He is VOA's White House bureau chief. He was speaking with our colleague Sarah Williams.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
For years, an annual caravan of Central American migrants traveling through Mexico to the U.S. border received modest public attention until President Trump condemned it in April, pitching the procession into the glare of the news media and actually into the homes of thousands of potential migrants. Though only a fraction of the 1,500 migrants made it to the United States, coverage of their trek in vehicles on foot inspired many considering that April journey to see caravans as a safer way to travel more than perilous trips that years had been taken before. Currently, there is another caravan of Central American migrants hoping to receive asylum in the U.S. VOA's Lori London speaks with the current about that current caravan with Justin Guest. He is assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University.
Well, this is political theater. There have been multiple caravans before, and many of them have sort of petered out in Mexico before reaching the U.S. border, and most of them have received very little attention. But this has received a lot more attention because President Trump has directed attention that way. And he's making it seem as if this is a brigade that is militarized and about to attack the United States and force their way in. When in reality, this is a very vulnerable group of people who is desperate to leave their country because it has grown very dangerous for them, life-threatening even, and are approaching the U.S. border to actually request rescue, to request refuge. And so it's a very different situation from the way he's describing it. And further, the United States actually has a number of procedures and infrastructure to actually deal with one person or 1,000 people who are making asylum requests. And that's precisely what the U.S. government will do anyway.
Last I heard, it might have been up to about 6,000 people. Of those 6,000, how many of them do you think would actually get to the U.S. border?
You know, it's impossible to know because really they have a lot of personal decisions to make. Many may settle in Mexico. Many may decide that it's not worth it or they get distracted or injured along the way. It's really impossible to know. But from the previous caravan that came, I believe it was a couple of years ago, I think a fraction ended up actually applying for asylum near San Diego. So it was not even close to the full amount that ended up actually reaching the U.S. border.
It seems striking. The U.S., the nation that welcomes the vulnerable, seems to have really shifted with this administration. My understanding is that there are many, many families, women, children that are really just fleeing violence and oppression in their country.
From media reports about who is, you know, what it's comprised of is, yes, it's vulnerable people, many of whom will qualify for the international standard of a refugee. Others will not meet those requirements. But in any case, they all are basically forced migrants, whether or not they're classified as refugees. They're leaving not because they want to leave their country, but because they have little choice due to either fear of persecution and violence or just very terrible poverty.
President Trump, we just learned, plans to actually send the military to the U.S.-Mexico border. What would they be able to do, and why such a dramatic measure when they haven't even arrived and we don't know what the situation is?
Well, the military uses violence to protect people or to actually gain territory or make an offensive move. Neither is really necessary here because the immigrants who are going to be approaching the border are not actually interested in fighting with anyone. They'll actually be filing applications using paper and legal statements about why they should be able to enter the United States, on what grounds. So it's unclear what the military would do other than to keep peace, but there's really no violence to be anticipated from the migrants' perspective. It's really unclear why the military would be necessary.
My understanding is they're not allowed to use any kind of force on people. at the borders?
The United States already has a very highly trained and numerous Customs and Border Patrol personnel at the border, CBP. And this is precisely what their job is. It is to actually consider and process applicants for admission and to manage the border in a day-to-day way. Having, you know, a few thousand people come to the border will mean more people than they usually have to process, but I see no reason why anything would be different other than longer lines and more things to consider.
Justin Guess is an assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University. He was speaking with VOA's Lori London. This is VOA.
I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. A trend toward populism in the United States and Europe is also sweeping Latin America's largest nation. What are the implications for Brazil and the region if Brazilians elect right-wing populist Jair Bolsonaro? Next on Encounter, we preview Brazilian elections with two experts. That's Encounter, Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in. Feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. And ahead of Sunday's second round presidential election in Brazil, that'll be October 28th, social media, the Liberal Party there, and the former military officer Jair Bolsonaro maintaining a strong lead in pre-election polls over the ruling leftist Workers' Party hopeful, who is Fernando Haddad. Bolsonaro raised alarm last week when he said he wants to return Brazil to the way it was 40 or 50 years ago when there was a military dictatorship. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Peter Hockham, President Emeritus and Senior Fellow at the Inter-American Dialogue, about that.
Yeah, I think what he means is he thinks that the country should be certainly a stronger sense of order, stronger discipline, wants a crackdown on crime, and what has become a security nightmare for many in Brazil. And 40, 50 years ago, at least for a short period of time, the military had the country growing pretty rapidly, and things seemed better ordered than they do today.
He's regarded, I think, fairly as a polarizing figure. He has made comments that some regard as racist, homophobic, and sexist. What makes him so popular, even among women?
From what I gather is that people see him as talking plainly in plain Portuguese, if you like. He communicates well. He says what he wants. People say we don't need these politicians who beat around the bush and are convoluted in what they say and don't really mean what they say. Bolsonaro, what they said about Trump is he says what's on his mind and he gets it out. He's not afraid to express himself, and he talks like one of us, and that reassures us.
Do the Brazilian voters overlook the remarks and focus on what they hope he'll do, and that is control crime, corruption, and improve the economy?
I think a lot of voters overlooked it. Others saw him promoting an agenda they wanted to see more of, and so they overlooked his uncivil comments, his racist comments. And others sort of said, hey, you know, he exaggerates. He really doesn't mean that. He's just a plain talker like all of us in conversation, and that's not what's important. What's important is we need change in Brazil. We need more discipline. We need order. We need economic growth. And the traditional parties don't have a clue of how to give it to us.
Peter Hockham is President Emeritus, Senior Fellow at the Inter-American Dialogue. He was speaking with my colleague, Victor Beatty. During the fall season in the United States, pumpkin festivals are popular. That's right, pumpkins. They typically feature fun activities like wandering through a corn maze, maybe going on a hayride, picking a pumpkin off the vine. Well, VOA's Deborah Block takes us to Butler's Orchard. That's a family-owned farm outside of Washington where people search for the perfect pumpkin.
The pumpkin theme is everywhere at Butler's Orchard in Germantown, Maryland. It has thousands of pumpkins, including a pumpkin patch where people can pick their own pumpkin. There are also other things to do, like riding a pony, plunging down a slide, or walking around a corn maze with its confusing winding pathways.
Every year, there's always one or two people that will call our farm market, our office, and say they're lost in the corn maze and they can't get out.
A hayride takes visitors to a large pumpkin patch. Some children discover the big orange fruits weigh more than they think.
That was really heavy.
Tristan Piazza plans to carve his pumpkin for Halloween.
I'm gonna make the scariest face in the whole neighborhood.
The Butler family owns the 120-hectare farm. Visitors, in season, can pick their own fruits, vegetables, and flowers. Butler's Orchard opened more than 60 years ago as one of the first pick-your-own farms in the area. 89-year-old Shirley Butler and her late husband came up with the idea.
And it's a delight to go out on the farm, which I do a lot, and see the beautiful pumpkins in the field. I have people coming out of the field and thanking me for it. So it makes a fun time for everybody.
Ken Merriam brought his children.
I'm a kid at heart.
He says Butler's Orchard brings back good memories of growing up on a farm in Honduras.
It's a little bit of what I used to have as a kid, so that's why I think it's nice to bring them over here, get them out of the city.
Shirley Butler's grandchildren, who are in their 30s, are now the third generation to run the farm. General Manager Tyler Butler says children, who usually only see pumpkins in grocery stores, can learn how pumpkins are grown and tell Tyler.
I didn't know pumpkins came from a vine. There's flowers on this vine. There's roots.
These little girls are learning about pumpkins during their first trip to a pumpkin patch.
To feel, you know, the nature and the fruits.
For Tristan Piazza's mother, the fall festival is an annual event.
My parents have always brought me. I bring my kid now. I hope he stays in the area and he can bring his kids.
Since family farms are hard to keep afloat these days, Tyler Butler appreciates the tens of thousands of visitors who come to the fall festival each year. Deborah Block, VOA News, Germantown, Maryland.
Yeah, many thanks for that, Debbie. I've been to Butler's Orchard. Great place to go. If you're ever around Washington, you should check it out. Still ahead on International Edition, the sounds of Bruce Hornsby. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Washington State University-led study proposes that a single domestication event some 3,600 years ago in what is now Central America led to the production of chocolate that many of us enjoy today. After analyzing the genome of cacao trees, the researchers say they were able to determine when the trees were first domesticated by ancient Americans to produce superior cacao beans, which in turn provides the basis for making excellent chocolate. According to the study, some of the qualities that those domesticating the cacao trees focused on included flavor, resistance to disease, and that it produced a stimulant called theobromide. Researchers noted that developing and enhancing those qualities also resulted in lower crop yields. While they may have been domesticated in Central America, the scientists say the cacao trees originated near what is today's border of southern Colombia and northern Ecuador. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It's time now for a little something from the world of music. Bruce Hornsby Bobby is an American singer and pianist. He draws frequently from classical, jazz, bluegrass, folk, Motown, gospel, rock, blues, jam band musical traditions. He likes it all. Hornsby also has achieved recognition for his solo albums and performances, including his touring band, Bruce Hornsby and the Noisemakers, as well as Bruce Hornsby and the Range. The Way It is one of their super hits.
Standing in line, marking time, waiting for the welfare dime. They can't buy a job. Man in a silk suit hurries by as he catches the poor old lady's eyes. Just for fun, he says, get a job. That's just the way it is. Some things will never change. That's just the way it is. Ah, but don't you believe them? Said, hey, little boy, you can't go where the others go. You don't look like they do. Said, hey, old man, how can you stand to think that way? Did you really think about it? Before you make the rules, he said, son, that's just the way it is. Some things will never change. That's just the way it is. Oh, but don't you believe that?
Hornsby was born in Williamsburg, Virginia, not far from Washington. He grew up in a musical household. His attorney father was a former musician. His brothers were big into music and collaborating with Bruce as songwriters. And Hornsby's recording Every Little Kiss was a big success, charting on Billboard's Hot 100. Music has been recognized on a number of occasions with awards, including the 1987 Grammy Award for Best New Artist, the 1990 Grammy Award for Best Bluegrass Album, and the 1994 Grammy for Best Pop Instrumental Performance. And Mandolin Rain was a big hit for Bruce Hornsby and the Range, co-written with his brother John and featuring Range member David Mansfield on the title instrument.
Thank you.
like the times that we spent hiding out from the rain under the carnival tent. I laughed and she'd smile, it would last for a while. You don't know what you got till you lose it all again. Listen to the
Hornsby and his wife Kathy have twin sons. They were born in 1992 and were named after musicians Leon Russell and Keith Jarrett.
Cool evening dance, listen to the bluegrass band, takes the chill from the air until they play the last song. I'll do my time for keeping you off my mind, but there's moments that I find I'm not feeling so.
Hornsby also collaborated with a lot of people, still is doing so, lots of entertainers, Patti LaBelle, just many of them, many of my favorites. Enjoy him a lot. Hey, listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead. We hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington hoping you have a great Friday. Now a bit more from Bruce Hornsby.
Running down by the lakeshore, she did love the sound of a summer storm. It's washing her away once again, again. Whoa, yeah. About her when I hear that whistle blow. I can't change my mind. Oh, I knew all the time that she'd go, but that's a choice I made long ago. Listen to the
This is Today in History. The Battle of Agincourt gave the English a decisive victory over the French in the Hundred Years' War. The English triumph paved the way for England's domination of most of France until the middle of the 15th century. On this day in 1854, one of the best-known military blunders in history took place during the Crimean War. Miscommunication of an order caused British Lord James Cardigan to lead a disastrous charge of his light brigade cavalry, a move that cost him 40% casualties in the face of Russian artillery. On this day in 1764, future President John Adams married Abigail Smith. The couple's prolific correspondence during their married life focused on an array of public concerns and shed light on discussions about the role of women in the new nation. In 1881, Pablo Picasso, considered one of the greatest artists of the 20th century, was born in Malaga, Spain. In 1929, during the Teapot Dome scandal, Albert B. Fall, who served as Secretary of the Interior in President Warren G. Harding's cabinet, was found guilty of accepting a bribe while in office. Fall was the first American to be convicted of a crime committed while serving in the cabinet. In 1940, Benjamin O. Davis Sr. was named the first black general in the United States Army. In 1962, author John Steinbeck was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature. And in 1971, the United Nations ceded the People's Republic of China and expelled the Republic of China, or Taiwan. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
This is VOA.